Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. And we are beginning the show today by talking about trees with Paul Segan. Paul is a DNR forest health specialist in northwest Wisconsin. Been with us many times. It's great to have him back. We'll start by talking about oaks and then go on to take a look at the status of the emerald ash borer. And Paul's going to have some advice to share on planting and caring for trees and shrubs. And as we talk with Paul, I hope you will join in. What concerns do you have about perhaps your oak trees? Questions about emerald ash borer, maybe about planting trees in fall. Join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Paul Segan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks for the invitation back.
Been a tough year for oaks. Maybe talk about what's causing the stress.
Yeah, it has been. When we think about one of the emblematic species of Wisconsin's forests, oaks really come to mind quickly because we see oaks in all types of different tree habitats in Wisconsin. We see them in the central sands around Adams County and Portage County, up in the Northwest Sands and Burnett, Washburn County. But we also see them occupy the far north and some of the mixed northern hardwood forests, as well as the driftless area down in the savannas. Think oak savannas. So oaks are a really important tree species for us all around, but they have been in trouble in the last few years. And if we look at some of the reasons why, it's a collection of different factors. As you recall in some of our earlier conversations, the state did enter into drought or abnormally dry conditions back since about 2022. And that drought cycle lasted about 3.5 years through about 3 growing season. And it eased to some extent last year, but then picked up again in the fall. This year, in this growing season in 2025, we've seen really good correction of the drought cycle and a much more average precipitation year and temperature year. But in that ensuing time, when we had that drought cycle, we did see a really big blow up of the spongy moth caterpillar, which defoliates oaks. We saw some other early season defoliators start to outbreak, including the oak leaf roller, the oak leaf tire, these early June types of defoliators. And then we saw some kind of oddballs pop up too, like the red striped oak worm. We get things like wood borers that can move in and take advantage of that stress, such as the native two-line chestnut borer, a wood boring beetle, and our malaria root disease, a very common and ubiquitous root disease that goes after a stressed tree. So with the collection of those factors sort of incited by the drought, oaks have taken a hit on multiple fronts. And so what that's caused is mortality in various areas across the state. And so far this year, we've mapped tens of thousands of acres in the far northwest part of the state, up in Bayfield County, as well as in southeast Wisconsin, where we've mapped oaks that are in decline or that have died in the last couple of years. And what you would look for to see that is basically oaks that have just no leaves left. The crown would be completely gray. Or if the oak is in the process of declining, we'd see a lot of crown dieback, where we see the outer portions of the branches without leaves and gray crown at that point. In that case, it doesn't necessarily mean the oak is going to die for sure, but it means that it's under stress and some of these effects are still lingering. If we think about, the health of oaks, we know that it takes years for a tree to build up its carbohydrate reserves from the photosynthesis. It's producing and manufacturing sugars and packing them into the roots each year, and it builds up a reserve. But over several years of consecutive stress, like defoliation, this reserve starts to wear down. And so these trees, when they get stressed out, they're going to need time to build those reserves back up and recover. Some of them are going to recover, and we've seen that, or the process is starting. Some of them just won't recover based on how bad they got affected and the types of sites they grow on.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about oak wilt, which is, of course, a big concern here in the state. And I imagine, well, a couple of things. One, some of those attacks could probably look a bit like oak wilt. And at the same time, if the tree is weakened, then it gives more of an opportunity for oak wilt to come in.
Yeah, absolutely. I have been thrown through a loop like in the last 3 years in my career on the Forest Health team, like never before, trying to decipher trees that are actually oak wilt infected versus declining or showing symptoms from other causes, such as the two-line chestnut borer. And so there's a number of other issues to be aware of that could look like oak wilt, but would have vastly different management implications if they're determined not to be oak wilt. So backing up for a second, oak wilt is the most lethal and serious disease of oaks that we have in the state. It generally affects the red oaks to a greater degree. Red oaks are those trees that have the more of the pointy leaves. White oaks are a bit more immune to oak wilt. They can survive it if they get it. But oak wilt is very severe in red oaks. And so deciphering it from other causes is really important. And so some of the other things we've been seeing going on are some fungal diseases of oak leaves. Two that really come to mind that we've seen a lot of, and these are coming out of our observations on the Forest Health team, but also Brian Huddleston's lab, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the state, are a pretty good prevalence of Tabakia leaf spot, a fungal disease on oaks that can infect the oak leaves, leaving behind circular blotches on the leaves, causing leaves to fall off the crown, usually the lower portion of the crown first. And that can cause a mild stress on the tree, usually happens in late season. We've been seeing a lot of it in August, but definitely you won't see the level of leaf loss like you would with oak wilt. Oak wilt, we generally see start around early July, last through about September. And during that time, leaves fall off the tree crown precipitously. Within a few weeks, most of the leaves are generally off. So oak wilt, very rapid leaf loss. Tabakia, some leaf loss, generally a different type of leaf characteristic. Another one that's been pretty prevalent is anthracnose. Now, this is another fungal disease, not as severe as oak wilt. It's more like tabakia in terms of its impact on the tree health, but it will cause leaves to fall off occasionally and cause leaves to kind of have a little bit of a crinkled edge to them and some blotches around the veins of the leaves that look a little bit dead or what we call necrotic. Very different looking than oak wilt generally in terms of the leaf loss. Yes, not as many leaves are falling from the tree. So tabakia and anthracnose, very important to consider as well. This two-line chestnut borer I talked about, this opportunistic stress-loving wood borer goes after the stressed oak. And oftentimes we see it start at the top of a tree and over several years start to cause branch dieback that usually leads to leaves staying in the tree. They don't fall off so quickly. They're often retained in the crown of the tree. And we see progressive dieback over multiple years. That really helps decipher it from oak wilt because when we're seeing kind of a slower decline, we generally can rule out oak wilt pretty easily because we know oak wilt, once infects a tree, tends to cause leaf loss and whole tree mortality within the same season, as opposed to a more progressive meter dieback over several years. So, yeah, a couple of things that we want to try to discern between oak wilt, because if we did have oak wilt, the management recommendations are vastly different and usually more aggressive. Some of these leaf diseases, we usually don't need to do a whole lot about. They can clear up when we get away from more wet, kind of moist weather patterns.
So before we go to the phones, I want to continue with this just another minute or two. And Phyllis and Jerry, we'll get to you in just a minute or two here. But there's at least two different treatment things here, or two different things we ought to be doing for our trees. Whether it's oak wilt or whether it's something else, what about care in the fall season? Is there anything we can do to help those oaks?
Yeah, I think when we think about things that are going after oaks due to stress, which includes some of these fungal diseases, tabakia, anthracnose, even some of the defoliators like the oak worm, the pink or red striped oak worm, and for sure two-line chestnut borer, these are stress-loving insects. And so to the extent we can reduce tree stress, we can make them more resistant to the initial invasion by some of these pests. So things to keep our trees healthier would be to, of course, during the growing season, avoid any kind of change in grade around the tree within that kind of drip line, which is the drip line is defined as about how far out the branches on all sides go. Really don't want to drive on that area. Really don't want to add soil to that area. Don't want to dig if there's any kind of digging work that needs to happen. The further it can be away from that drip line, the better it's going to be. And then, of course, during periods of dry weather, when things dip down below average, which average is about a week of an inch of water per week during our growing season in Wisconsin, when we dip below that, it can be beneficial to water trees with a soaker or drip hose that can provide some water during those times of stress and drought. Usually not as important with larger established trees, but over the last 3 years, that could have made the difference in a number of times. The other thing really with oak trees is to avoid any pruning, wounding, or cutting of oaks during that critical time frame of April through July every year. And that's because oak wilt can move into a tree if they're cut, pruned, wound during that time. So that's a big one, is to really focus on pruning after we've had a really strong frost or when we're getting into November time.
And for oak wilt, it's probably, I don't know, is it better? You need to get somebody in who knows what they're doing?
Generally, so. Our webpage, the DNR Forest Health webpage, has quite a few good references, a couple of fact sheets, one on oak wilt, one on oak wilt management, that have some really good pictures. And once you see the leaf characteristic of oak wilt, it's pretty a diagnostic of oak wilt. But yes, there are some other things that can kind of look similar to it. Bacterial leaf scorch, for example, sometimes tabakia. And so it's a good idea to have trees tested if you're not really a professional or working with the assistance of a professional. And our Forest Health Lab does do testing for woodland owners who own acreage of forest. There's free testing that we can provide if you contact us and schedule a site visit. But also the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison also does 4-fee testing to isolate oak wilt or some of these other more benign diseases. And that can be a really good idea, again, when we're talking about the gravity of oak wilt control, which is much more involved generally.
Let's go to Phyllis in Winona, Minnesota now with a different kind of question. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I actually have two questions. I recently bought a property that has two big trees in the backyard, which were identified to me as hackberry. They're nice big shade trees. They look healthy, but the backs of almost every leaf is covered with galls. I mean, just covered with it. So they look horrible when they fall on the ground. Anyway, my understanding from researching it is it doesn't harm the tree, but they look disgusting. Is there any kind of treatment or anything I can do to prevent that or reduce it?
Yeah, this is a hackberry gall, and they're really common in a lot of different trees. They get galls from wasps that often, in fact, lay their eggs in these leaves, and we get these developments of kind of globular or rounded areas that kind of well up around the leaf. And oftentimes what it is, it's a tree response to that egg-laying event or oviposition that happens in the leaf. And these are almost always benign in terms of their effect on the tree. They usually don't impact the health because the tree's still able to photosynthesize and manufacture those sugars in spite of this leaf looking really odd. Now, with hackberry gall, I wouldn't worry too much about it. I don't think there's going to be any control. I will double check that, but I would say if you can tolerate the appearance of it, it's really not going to have an impact on the tree's overall health. And, like a lot of galls, they look pretty severe, but are really benign in nature.
Phyllis, you had a second question?
I do. I recently had a couple of new trees planted, and I was told, I always thought you had new trees, you just put the garden hose up by the base and watered them a good bit. Now they told me that that's not recommended. They want, I don't know, you have a sprinkler or something that's watering the entire area with the root ball. That's not really convenient where I'm at there. So I put a soaker hose under the mulch, but I'm not sure it's really working. I wonder if he has comments about this new method of watering a new tree.
Yeah, newly planted trees really benefit from watering. And there has been a little bit of a change of thought on how frequent one should water. In the past, at least for established trees, it was really that a less frequent, more thorough watering, maybe every 7 to 10 days during dry periods, was a good thing. And it's still a good thing, but more for established trees under dry conditions. When we're talking about newly planted trees, it's really important to assess the moisture level in the root ball, that immediate area where the roots are that have been planted, and see if it's dry in the upper two inches of that root ball. If it does seem dry, watering every 3 to 4 days, not a real thorough watering, slightly lighter, but more frequent every few days can be beneficial. Now, that watering regime can kind of taper off over about a month as the tree becomes a little bit more adapted to that site. And you can maybe, you know, span it out to 7 to 10 days. But initially, yeah, you're going to want to water pretty frequently for these young plantings. And then the other thing is, yeah, soaker hoses and drip hoses, even buckets that have a small hole on the bottom that kind of are moved around periodically around that root ball are really beneficial. We want to soak that root ball and keep it with water, not excessively moist like watering every day, but enough water that tree starting to acclimate to the site and making sure its water status is not such that it might start wilting or become stressed to and susceptible to other pathogens or pests.
Phyllis, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Paul Segan, our guest today, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin, talking trees with him. Jerry, we'll get to you in just a minute, but a quick reminder, I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. We're taking a look at trees and tree health today with our guest, Paul Segan of the Department of Natural Resources. He is a forest health specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. Jerry in Spring Valley, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I've recently heard that a nursery I worked with sells bare root white pine trees for planting in the fall. I've never planted white pines in the fall, and I'm just wondering, what is the success rate in planting white pines in the fall, and what kind of special precautions might you need to take or preparations for the winter? If you plant bare root, then when should you actually be planting these trees in the fall?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, fall is a really good time to plant a whole variety, whether it's conifer or deciduous trees, but there's a slight variation in the best timing for those two groups, deciduous versus conifer. White pine fall into conifer, of course, they're cone-bearing trees, and so it's a little bit better to plant them earlier in the season, and kind of the ideal period would be about August through the end of September. And so this is a shifted forward a little bit. It's a little bit earlier than deciduous. And the reason is these conifers, and the reason you want to get them in the ground by about the end of September is that it gives them a little bit of time to acclimate to the site. They're going to adjust to that new planting site. They're going to grow a little bit of root material, and they're going to kind of harden up over the course of the rest of the fall. Hardening up means their buds and some of those tissues that grow the new growth next year are going to become a little bit more kind of hardy up against the cold weather during the winter. And so you want to give them enough time to do that. Also, of course, watering them after you plant can be really good. When we're talking about deciduous trees, we can push that out a little bit further. We're looking at about August through maybe early November for most areas in Wisconsin. It's a little bit wider window there. Again, with planting conifers, it's good to consider your site. White pine are very adaptable. Bare root seedlings, they can be planted in across a whole spectrum of different nutrient situations and water situations. But it is a good idea to get water on those trees after they're planted. And one thing I like to do when I plant bare root white pine, I did a lot this spring, is to, if you can select kind of a little bit of a rainy day, a damp day where there's not a lot of sunlight, it's not really warm, that's really beneficial because those small tender roots tend to dry out really quickly in the winds and the sun. And so keeping them protected, keeping them in maybe a watered bucket while you plant is really a good idea. Protect those tender roots before they get in the ground and then water away once they're in the ground.
Yeah. And water, you know, late into the season too, isn't it, Paul? I mean, you want to go to freeze up almost?
Yeah, usually to freeze up is what we want to target, whether it's deciduous or conifer. You really want to keep water in that tree until it starts to go dormant. And that's going to help keep a good water status as it goes into the winter. You know, sometimes I think about there could be some risks in overwatering too close to freeze up, because we don't want to have frost heaving of those nice tender roots where we're getting a little bit of expansion contraction in the soil, which could cause a little bit of damage and heaving of the tree itself. So I wouldn't go overboard with watering right at the end, but definitely enough water, maybe somewhat frequent lower volume water as we're getting into the first few frosts.
Let's turn to Liz in Madison next. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I'm asking about winter preparation for my 8-year-old yellow magnolia tree. This summer, she flowered, but then as she began to leaf out, the leaves didn't. They're a little bit curly, and they're not as big as they normally were, so they were a little bit stunted. I also noticed that a lot of the smaller branches towards that are closer to the trunk are like dead leaves. And so I'm wondering when to prune those off. And also the trunk towards the base of the ground has a lot of cracking in it. And so I'm just a little bit worried.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good question, Liz. I should ask you, have you mulched this magnolia?
Yes.
Okay, it is mulched. Okay, so you're seeing a little bit of some stunted growth in some of the lower branches. Leaves appear to be a little bit curly. Some are dead. I wonder if it could be a little bit of a nutrient issue. Generally, and I think about fertilization. And generally, established trees that are that old don't need much fertilization, if any, but if the site is a little bit nutrient poor, fertilization can benefit. And some signs that the site is not really providing is if we see stunted growth like that, if small leaves, a little bit of dieback, that's potentially a sign of fertilization issues. You could get a soil test to confirm what the nutrient levels are. The other idea is you've got this crack down at the base of the stem, which to me sounds like it could be the result of sun scald. This is the process whereby in the winter, warm sun hits usually the south and kind of west facing sides of that tree and can cause it to heat up. But then when it cools down at night, it kind of freezes again. And that process can damage those tissues, causing that crack. So a couple of ideas here. One would be when we get into the first frost or two, when we hitting dormant season, would be to wrap that stem with some tree wrap up to about 3 feet. What that's going to do is it's going to protect from any additional what could be sun scald in that case, and also protect against the damage from rodents and rabbits that might want to feed on that stem during winter as other food sources become scarce. Beyond that, as far as pruning goes, yes, I would recommend pruning out those lower limbs that are looking really, really kind of sick, but I would kind of wait until we get into November, until we get into dormancy. And the reason is I wouldn't want you to stimulate any new growth by doing that pruning. That could then end up not hardening off in time for winter and end up getting killed anyway. So those are a couple of thoughts: fertilization, wrapping, and then pruning once we get into the dormancy.
And fertilization, would we zero in on anything? Probably the best would be a soil test, but if you're a general recommendation on fertilizing?
Yeah, using a balanced fertilizer, something that's got a good balance, all-purpose of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium would be a good bet. And usually slow release is probably the way to go when we're talking about trees because of being the perennial nature of them. We don't want big bursts of nutrition all at once. We want to kind of stagger that out. So something with maybe time-released beads or even a tree stake might be appropriate.
Liz, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Annie in Janesville next. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about a 40-year-old oak tree, and we've had tree specialists and trimmers checking it out for us, and we're not remembering if it was one of them or something my husband read on the internet. but it's splitting at the top. It's got two branches going different ways. And so he tied it up, way up, and we've been seeing like a strip, like 15 inches or at least of a wet spot going down the whole trunk. And we don't know if that tying up is causing that or what is causing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like this tree got braced maybe because it had a weak branch union up at the top, and that's a fairly standard practice that arborists do. But I do know that with those anchors, it was likely that they inserted anchors into that tree, that led to the production of a wound there. And that wound could have been colonized by some bacteria that go after the phloem and xylem tissues in the wood, and they can cause this oozing effect to happen. At that stage, I don't know that there's much that can be done in terms of like a systemic fungicide, but usually we have either a bacterial infection or a fungal infection that might be moving into that wound. I would say monitor it and potentially have an arborist who's got skills in disease diagnostics to look at that tree closer if someone with that skill set and knowledge base hasn't done that already. A good resource I often refer people to if they're dealing with these individual tree issues is the list of certified arborists, which is on the, it's called treesaregood.org. And if you go to that website, you can find service providers right within your area based on your area code and distance from your area code. So I would say have it looked at by a professional who's got some knowledge with insect or disease issues in urban trees.
And what was the name of that site again to go to,
Paul? Trees. Yes, it's treesaregood.org.
Treesaregood.org. All right.
Yeah, it's part of the International Society of Arboriculture's website.
Annie, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Lois in Webster, your turn. Hi, Lois.
We seem to have a problem the last 2 years with our lilacs. All the lilacs in our area seem to look like they're dying. And so then this next year, we noticed a few green leaves starting to come back. What are we dealing with our lilac bushes?
Yeah, 2 years. Yeah. A year ago, I was getting all kinds of calls about lilacs. Not as many this year.
Yeah, that is a fungal disease, most likely, on the lilacs. It's been really prevalent. I'm trying to find the name of it right here. I'll get to you on that one, but it's drawing a blank on me, but it has been pretty common this season. Lilacs often getting really well defoliated as we're reaching that latter part of August and early September. A lot of blotches in the leaves, a lot of darkening coloration, lesions, and then defoliation. The name escapes me right now, but that is usually a disease that doesn't warrant much activity other than raking up the diseased leaves to try to get them off the site. And that's similar with a lot of these leaf diseases, is we don't want to have inoculum that's present on the leaves lingering near the tree, because it can be an additional source of infection the following year. So cleaning the site, getting that material away by composting it, burning it, or burying it is a really good idea. But yeah, I'll try to find that name, and maybe we can say that in a little bit here.
Okay, Lois, thank you for calling. And let's see, we have a question from Noah in New Glarus. You were talking about, when we were talking about oaks, you were saying don't drive over, you know, that area over the roots. And Noah wonders, he's got a riding lawnmower that he takes through an oak stand. Would that have the same effect on the trees as a heavier vehicle?
I don't think so. I think lawnmowers, you know, with their wider tires, which disperse the weight more broadly, are probably going to be just fine. I think also the soil type is a factor too. If you think about what soils are going to be prone to compaction, a few factors are present there. The texture of the soil, meaning how much sand, silt, or clay is in it, is going to be a factor, of course. And those soils with more clay are going to be more susceptible to compaction, as that clay really compresses. And that's not good for roots, because they can't get as much diffusion of oxygen down in the roots where they need that oxygen to break down the sugars that they manufacture in their leaves to live. So we have less oxygen and we have a little bit less water percolation as a result. So clays are more susceptible. Of course, when we get more rains after a wet period, or there's been, you know, a lot of saturating precipitation, that is a time we really wouldn't want to be driving too close to those trees, because of course, with more water in the soil, it's more prone to that compaction. Periods of wet weather during the growing season, but also during the spring warm-up, as a lot of the snow is melting, those are periods that are more prone to compaction. But generally, I don't think that lawnmower is going to be too much of an issue. We're talking about heavier vehicles, things like backing a boat up to it, or having a skid steer go by it, or even driving a big truck next to the tree. Generally, things we would want to avoid if possible.
Tanya in Arlington, Wisconsin, we'll give you a shot now. Thank you for calling, Tanya.
Good morning. Thanks for the show to both of you.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard the magnolia tree that had the split in the bark near the ground, and I have a linden tree that's about 4 years old and just noticed the splits. So you said to wrap it. Is it just in the winter? And then is there anything I can do to help the splits heal? That's my question.
Okay.
Yeah, good question on the linden. So it's already got the split on it. And the good news is that trees have a mechanism to heal themselves. They essentially grow callus tissue, which oftentimes can close that area of dead tissue off. And these callus tissue kind of grows on the edge of the injury. And over time, it can kind of grow to the point where it closes off that injury. So long as we're not talking about maybe a fungal infection or bacterial infection that's there as well. If it's simply mechanical damage, these wounds can close over time. That's really good news. But we want to prevent further damage on this tree, particularly if it's, you know, under about 4 inches in diameter. At that stage, that's when they're more susceptible to this effect of sun scald that we talked about earlier. And so to your question, yes, wrapping the tree is a good idea, but only during the winter period. We want to wait until we're getting into dormancy to put that wrap around the first 3 feet of the tree. And then we want to take it off pretty quickly in April, because you don't want to strangle the tree or prevent its growth or somehow constrain that movement of fluid through the stem, which leaving the wrap on could potentially do. And there might be glues and other, you know, adhesives that aren't really good for the plant tissue as well. So really kind of a strictly a winter protection mechanism. And hopefully that wound will close up on its own.
Tanya, thank you for calling. Let's turn to Kathy in Madison. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'm on the north side, so if you hear any airplanes, just be forewarned. Well, I have a bunch of pagoda dogwoods. The original one is probably 20 years old. Then there were babies, and I allowed them to grow. Anyway, they didn't have any seeds. They don't have any seeds this year. And usually I'm going crazy with squirrels in the dogwoods and knocking seeds everywhere. I called the Dane County horticulturist, Lisa Johnson. She hasn't heard about this at all. And then I walk around the neighborhood, and I see the same thing on other dogwoods. Have you heard of this?
The dogwoods are not producing seed, you said?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I do know dogwood is very prone to what's called golden canker, a fungal disease that can kill the twigs and branches. And I wonder if possibly that is caused the fruit-bearing or seed-bearing twigs to die and cause basically an absence of that production. That's just a guess, but I haven't heard of what's affecting actual seed production specifically. You know, are you on the tree itself, are you seeing any areas where the twigs look kind of a golden, kind of a yellow color?
Well, I haven't noticed that. I can look again. I haven't noticed a thing wrong with them, which is why I suddenly realized 2 weeks ago, where are the seeds? The trees seem perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed on my pagoda dogwoods in my yard, there is a little bit of golden canker on it. And so most of the crown of some of them have actually died, and they will basically turn this kind of yellow or gold color, and there won't be any production on it. Leaves will wilt, and it's really just the skeleton of the branch and twigs that remains. So could that affect seed production too? Well, if there's no living tissue, of course it will, but I would think you would have seen symptoms similar to that if that's the effect. Otherwise, that one kind of stumps me.
Yeah. And you're further north, so, and Kathy, you're way north, Kathy's south, so maybe it just hasn't gotten around to I mean, you're getting cooler up there than we are here, so I'm guessing.
Yes, yeah, the fall, the early, the signs of early autumn are setting in here. It's really pretty.
Kathy, thank you for calling. And Kim in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim.
Hello, Larry. Hello, guest. We have a maple tree that lost its main trunk going up that split off. And I'm wondering if the secondary branch that goes up will turn into the main, and is it salvageable or should we destroy it?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think what it depends on is how it kind of depends on the overall shape of the branch that came off, how big it was, and what size the wound left behind is. Can you tell me the branch that broke off or the stem, how large was that in diameter roughly?
Probably a good 8 inches at least. It was the main, you know, the main trunk going up.
Yeah. Kim, now when it broke off, did it tear? Did it tear off some of the bark lower down with it?
It did, but I cut off and sealed the trunk that was exposed. I cut it off at an angle so it'd kind of shear water away.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. And the one that remains that you're hoping kind of takes over, what diameter is that one?
It was pretty close to the same diameter. It just wasn't the main trunk.
Okay. And is the tree close to a structure, your house or a garage, something like that?
It's a good 15 feet away from the house.
Okay, 15 feet away from the house. A couple of considerations here. That is a pretty large wound that's left behind, and it's a pretty large branch or main stem that broke off. And so I think it's going to be very likely that there is going to be decay entering into that area, and it's going to continue to fester and lead to eventually decay in a cavity at that site. Now, maples are pretty resilient. They can kind of cope with this like oaks can and some other species for a long time. But over time, that tree is going to become more prone to wind snap and other environmental conditions such as drought, which are going to strain that tree. So if it's in a site that's really prized for you, like you really want to make sure you have a nice tree there, I would kind of weigh and balance the fact that this tree might not live forever. It's going to be compromised. You might want to start over versus, well, maybe the site's not that important and having that tree there for now is what you want. The fact that it's not next to a building or a structure means that if it were to break, I think it might be sufficiently far where it might not cause hazard, though I can't speak for sure, not seeing the site. I'd say it's kind of a coin toss. One thing I do want to bring up, though, is something you did to this wound, which was to spray with pruning sealant. And pruning sealants are an interesting product that we sometimes talk about in the tree health world. And I think it's worth mentioning that generally in cases like this, we wouldn't recommend applying a pruning sealant to that injured portion of the tree. And the reason is that callus tissue I talked a little bit earlier with that other tree is often inhibited with the use of these petroleum-based tree sealants. And so we really want to reserve these for very specific uses. And the one specific use that we will recommend a tree sealant for is when we're trying to prevent oak wilt in freshly pruned oaks or cut stumps of oaks during that April through July period. An immediate application of that pruning sealant to oaks is really important in preventing oak wilt and is far worth the benefit of potentially causing some damage to the tissue. We're talking about things like maple and non-oak species. We really want to try to avoid that if we can, because they're not really doing a whole lot of good, but they are doing a little bit of harm to that tissue. So,
Kim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Paul Segan, our guest today, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up in the second hour of the show, we'll be talking with Mark Conlock, director of the Green Bay Botanical Gardens, and we'll be taking a close look at spring bulbs and maybe spring bulbs for your lawn. That at the top of the hour. Right now, we're looking at your trees with Paul Segan of the DNR, and Carolyn Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Larry. I'm calling about a large oak in our backyard. We moved into the house about 6 years ago, and at the time it was sort of lime green, and we had an arborist recommend treatment with iron, which we did. that seemed to help. But this year it was lime green again, and the arborist said, well, we should try a nutritional treatment of some sort, which he did. But not, I think it's coincidental, I don't know, but it turned about half brown by the time I noticed it, and then within another 2 weeks, and now it is completely brown.
The leaves, of course.
The leaves, yeah. And also about a year and a half ago, it was after an early spring storm last year, a very large branch broke off. So it was maybe 8 to 10 inches in diameter.
Hmm.
Okay, a couple of things going on. It's hard to say. So you had a new kind of a fertilization regime here. Was this a pin oak by chance? Was it a type of red oak? Maybe it was a pin oak?
No, it's a red or a white oak, and I couldn't tell you offhand. I don't remember.
Are the leaves kind of pointed?
Gosh, I'd have to go out and look.
Yeah, this iron deficiency can be common in some areas of southern Wisconsin based on the soils. And so what you are describing is a common symptom of that, which is this kind of chlorotic leaf tissue. Leaves look a little bit lime green or off color, even pale green, a sign of a nutrient deficiency. Iron is one of them. I think addressing it like you did was not a bad idea, but I do wonder, could it have been burnt a little bit by the fertilization regime? Maybe it was, maybe the dose was a little high. I'm not really an expert on that area of the soil nutrition, but I do wonder if maybe something could have been a little bit wonky with that regime. The other thing you mentioned is this large branch breaking last fall, and that can lead to oak wilt, but generally when the branches break outside of that April through July window, there's really not as much of a risk. There can be some risk, but usually it's quite a bit reduced compared to that other risk period. So I'm thinking it's probably not oak wilt. The leaves that are on the tree that turn brown, are they still hanging on the tree?
Yeah, they are. I'm out here looking at it. It is completely brown, but the leaves are still on it.
Okay. Any greenness to the leaves at all? And did any of them fall down that you can on the lawn that you can look at?
Yeah, I just picked one up. And what was the question about the leaves?
Any green coloration, or what's the general pattern on the leaf?
Oh, it's completely brown with just a couple of black spots.
Couple of black spots. Interesting. Yeah, that sounds really systemic if it's across the whole leaf, the whole crown of the tree. I think your probably best bet would be to get a couple of twigs and maybe a small branch cut off and sent into the plant disease diagnostic clinic to get a test to see if there could be a bacterial, fungal, or potentially some kind of other agent. Maybe it's a nutrient agent that's causing that effect. But the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic will accept samples for about $30, and they can test. And with a tree that's that important to you that you've obviously invested in, I would want to get that get the diagnosis right on it. And without seeing it and doing a little bit more of a site evaluation, it's hard to say.
So you could go to the, if you just type in UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW Plant Disease Clinic, it's going to pop up on your search engine, and you get the directions on how to send a sample in. And I do it soon. You know,
yes,
this would be a good time to maybe do it, although he prefers to not have the sample sitting in the over a weekend, but I do it soon.
Yeah, I would too. The sooner you can figure that out, the sooner you can develop kind of a management strategy, whether it's something you do next year, or hopefully it's something that's going to be ephemeral and short-lived with this tree, but sooner rather than later to find out is good.
Thanks, Carol. Dave in Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have a question. I have a neighbor down the road from me, not too far, who has about 7 or 8 big mature oak trees that have been diagnosed with oak wilt, and he's gotten a bid to take them down later this fall. And what I'm wondering about is he wants to, I think he's going to offer me some of that wood or have me help him cut it for firewood. And so... what I'm wondering is if it's kind of dangerous to take those slices of firewood to my place, which I have a lot of oaks too. Was there any chance of those infecting my trees?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, how far away do you live from the site with the oak wilt?
Not too far, probably a quarter mile at the most. So I'm a little
nervous
scared that someday mine are going to get it.
Yeah. So I think that's a good consideration. What I would see if the landowner you're working with is willing to allow you to leave the wood on the site for a calendar year at the place where the oak wilt is, and I'll tell you how to deal with the handling of that wood, but then to pick it up the following year, that would be the best case scenario. I would not move that wood from the site, because what we know about oak wilt is it's spread long distances when we move infected firewood to a site like you're proposing to do. And when it gets to that site, small beetles visit the infected wood and carry fungal spores away with them to freshly injured oaks. Now, you might, in good intention, not harm your oaks at all during April through July, because you know about that disease now and how it spreads. But you can't control Mother Nature, and if you get an untimed storm that happens in the middle of June, you might have a fire on your hands, so to speak, with oak wilt. So what I would recommend, see if once they remove those trees, they can keep them on the site, and the best strategy would be to either to tarp those logs as whole logs with plastic. You can buy various mill size plastic in wrap at, say, Menards or another type of store, and cover that wood on all sides and bury the edges into the ground. The other thing you could do is you could cut it up into firewood and then, you know, let the wood sort of dry out, but keep it tarped. The big thing is keep the wood on the site it's at and try to tarp it in the form of whole logs down to about 4 inches, or cut firewood, split firewood. What that's going to do is it's going to prevent beetles from being able to access that infected wood and spread the disease from there. After July 15th next year in 2026, the risk of spore production in that wood has declined significantly, and that wood could then be taken to your house and used for firewood. But I wouldn't take it further than a quarter mile. I would still keep it pretty local like you're doing. But definitely don't bring it to your house, and definitely, if you can, have it tarped on that site. And maybe that's a good bargain. Maybe you offer to help with some of the disease, the special handling of that wood in exchange for getting some of that wood. I'd say that's a fair barter for the other landowner.
There you go, Dave. Thank you for calling. And Kathy in Oshkosh, do you have a quick question for us?
Yes, I got two trees. One is a maple that's rotting, so I need to get that cut down. And then about 50 feet from that, I have a birch tree that is going to need to be cut down. So I'm going to need to cut down these two trees. But I want to plant another tree in there, like I think it's called a rosebud. But I want to plant it in there, but I don't know if I could put it. How far away do I have to get it from the old stump area?
The only thing I would think about, there's two things. One is that you want to make sure that you're not planting over existing roots or stump material so that you can get your planting hole size correct. Usually we talk about planting a $1 tree and putting it in a $10 hole, meaning you want to take time to dig that hole nicely and make sure it's maybe at least 6 inches to a foot larger than the root ball of whatever you're going to plant. So making sure that existing root material is not getting in the way of that. The other thing is there is a disease called verticillium, which can be born in the soil, and that can affect some species of trees. So I would think I'd have to look specifically at the tree species that you're planning to plant, because maple is susceptible to verticillium, and it's possible it could linger in the soil. So I would check to see if that tree you're planting is susceptible to this disease called verticillium. And if it's not, I think just the first consideration is important, just making sure you can dig a good hole there. And then your birch tree, I don't think that birch are susceptible to verticillium, so I don't think it's as much of an issue there. I guess this is a good opportunity to talk about planting and tree selection generally. I would make sure that whatever you're planning to put at that site is going to be adapted to the growing conditions of the site. That you can look at the plant hardiness zone on the UW's website and determine if it's a good site and the tree is appropriate for it. So that's a good thing to think about.
Paul, you've been great. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit. Appreciate it very much.
Absolutely. There's always more to say about the plants we love, Larry, so I'll look forward to it.
Paul Segan, DNR Forest Health Specialist in Northwest Wisconsin, our guest. He'll be back. Coming up, we'll take a look at bulbs. Now's the time to plant them. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are turning our attention to bulbs. Have you ever heard about a bulb lawn or maybe a partial bulb lawn? That's what we'll be talking about, at least in part, with our guest Mark Conlock. Mark is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and he'll be talking about using spring bulbs in your garden. He'll also give us a sneak preview of this year's holiday display at the garden, and we'll talk about all kinds of things relating to the flower gardens and take your gardening questions. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mark Conlock, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Let's talk about bulb lawns to begin with. What is a bulb lawn?
Yeah, we have a couple of them here at the botanical garden where we've had, I mean, especially in Nomo grass mix, we have planted different things like grape hyacinth, a species tulip, a dwarf daffodil mixed together in there. And then what happens is, you know, they will come up, they come up actually somewhat different times. So it adds color throughout the early parts of the spring months. And then it's a way to use more space of your garden to get color because it's your lawn that you don't typically have, you know, bulbs into. The one thing to know though is that after those bulbs, you know, do come up and flower, you do have to let the foliage, I call it dry down and die down, so that it will produce, you know, a bulb with a flower for the next year. So that typically means you have to wait a little bit to mow your grass, like say six-ish weeks after they bloom. So that's why we like to do it in the no-mow grass mix, because that's not grass that you typically mow that often. So that is like a good combination for anyone that has areas that they have switched over to that like less maintenance grass. And the other thing though is that you can do all those different things. Like there's a company called Color Blends that we use a lot is our source for our bulbs. And they have this part, if you go to their website, called Color Your Grass. And it's kind of a funny play on words, I guess. But, you know, they have like already made mixes of different combinations that you can just buy, that you can, you know, throw on your grass and plant. And the other kind of cool thing about that is those bulbs are usually smaller miscellaneous bulbs, so you don't have to dig them as deep down, so it's a little less work for planting. You know, most bulbs only go 2 to 3 times deep as they are wide, so those bulbs all being little small guys, you know, they barely need to get like knifed into the ground a little bit. So the other quick last thing I was going to share is, you know, in our botanical garden last year, we had quite a bit of deer damage. So this year, what we're going to do is like use a lot more of different kinds of bulbs, including especially daffodils, but then use these color your grass mixes in our actual annual perennial planting beds to add to like the color and the interest throughout the whole season to, in essence, make up for tulips. You know, they don't have the same amazing color palette as tulips do, but they will give us like color early, mid, and late to go in with our other bulbs, including the daffodils we've chosen. So last thing is that a lot of those color your grass guys are critter proof for all of us out there that have issues with animals.
Well, I was thinking, you mentioned tulips. I would typically, if it was me, I might stay away from tulips and maybe hyacinths and go with the smaller.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely the tulips, you know, like we love them though for all the different colors, but yeah. if you have, you know, the deer problems, especially, it can be challenging to, you know, keep them going. So we're going to shy away this year from it until we know that we don't have those animals eating. But like you said, tulips are definitely the one that animals, deer, rabbits like the most. So if you have those issues, you should, you know, spend your money elsewhere, I would say. And there's a lot of other available bulbs that you can find.
Yeah. John wants to know, will the bulbs multiply?
Yes, definitely. Especially like our daffodil bulbs have multiplied over the years in our garden. So a couple interesting things about that is, you know, if you have a, you know, area with where they have multiplied, you can, if you don't have a huge amount of them, take the time, you know, later after they've flowered to dig them out, separate them and spread them throughout your garden so that they can then get the nutrients they need to produce a flower the next year, because sometimes in our areas that has gotten to be the case where they'll have foliage now and no longer have a flower because they're so tightly packed that they can't mine the soil for enough nutrients. The other thing I heard from Brent of Brent and Becky's Bulbs way back in the day on the presentation he gave was he said he would, instead of doing all the work of transplanting them, fertilize that clump of bulbs after it was done flowering, or if it didn't flower in the times the other ones were done with, like, he just said he used 10-10-10 fertilizer to, you know, have enough fertility around where those roots are so that they have the energy to not only translocate the energy back to the bulb in the ground to make leaves, but they need the more, you know, energy to make the flower bud. So that's why they don't flower, is because there's not enough, you know, nutrients in the soil for them to find what they need to make that flower bud. So a couple of ideas are either divide them if that gets to be the case, or fertilize around them when they're doing the dry down part of the leaf so they have more energy and more nutrients to make that flower bud in the bulb.
So, you know, if you're putting them into a lawn, for example, what's the best way to dig the holes for those?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we did a couple of times is actually kind of an interesting thing. Like, we spray painted the bulbs with like neon marking paint that you can get at, you know, Menards, Home Depot, or the box stores or anywhere. And so that we could find them in the lawn in the first place, because we had like, you know, 30,000, we spray painted them. Now you can just like throw them and pitch them into the lawn. That's kind of the nice part of the design, is it's more of an informal look. And then what we would do is use our soil knives to like knife them into the ground. So yeah, the hard part is you have to dig 30,000 baby holes.
People with their lawns, are they wouldn't be doing 30,000 of them, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. And then you know, you could use a like an auger they sell, you know, but you don't usually need the hole to be that big for these little guys that are in the grass. Yeah. Or the other thing you could do actually is like take a spade or a shovel, and you can kind of like take up a clod of sod almost, and then throw a handful in there and then just like pat it back down in place. And that's a way to plant like a lot of bulbs fast in a little spot. It's just that they're all like jammed together, you know, so you might want to do that 5 or 7 different like clumps of that, you know, throughout your lawn space. But that's sometimes another way that we'll do it, or we'll do a combo of the sod pieces and then sprinkle in between so it's not so many knife holes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Ellie in Middleton emailed to say they have a variety of irises and daffodils in their gardens. Can Ellie divide them in the fall, or is it a spring-only activity?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. Usually, I mean, the daffodils, if she knows, you know, where they are and she like marked them in the springtime, say, I would say you could do that in the fall, because that's typically when you buy and plant those bulbs, you know, from a store. So that's no problem. And from what I know about irises, a lot of times, you know, people do buy those in the fall and divide them then. So like a lot of times you'll see people, you know, like that's when they do actually sell irises, is like root crops. So I always say go for it.
And fall planting is really kind of ideal for bulbs, is it not?
Yeah, the spring blooming bulbs are planted in the fall. So it is the time that you do that, yes.
So that makes the most sense. But, you know, we always get questions. I forgot to plant my bulbs in the fall. Can I store them over winter?
Well, I mean, what happens is the bulbs need a chilling period. You know, there's like a plant growth regulator called gibberellic acid that has to like get to certain levels for them to do stem elongation in the springtime, from what I remember about my horticulture degree at River Falls back in the day. And if they don't have that, you know, they're not successful. Also, what happens is when you plant your bulbs in the fall, we usually will water them into the, you know, water them in. And because what happens is it like hydrates the organelles of the bulb. And in the fall, the bulbs actually put their roots down. So if you don't have them in the soil, you know, it's kind of like too late to do it in the springtime. You know, what you could do is investigate. There's actually a new article in the American Gardener magazine about forcing bulbs. So like there's an interesting article there about how to force all kinds of different bulbs, but they're typically not the normal tulip and daffodil that we grow in our climate. There are other different things like amaryllis, paper white, some small miscellaneous iris reticulata, crocuses, and like some smaller things. So I would guess all I would say is if you didn't get a chance to plant them in the fall, you might just have to buy some in pots from somewhere in a local garden center and wait till next year.
Well, what we're trying to say here is get them in this. And how much time do we have?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of time still, Larry. Like, it's a great time to go to those websites of different companies or go to a local, you know, garden center or even big box stores and find bulbs that are, you know, for sale right now. Typically, we actually don't start planting our bulbs till around the first frost or the first, you know, weekish in October. A lot of that seems to have been, you know, changed and offset in the last, you know, couple of years, where it's like nice, long, warm falls, at least in Northeast Wisconsin, where, you know, we kind of get to a stage where we have to plant it to get all the work done with the time we have, but it may not be exactly the right time to do it, you know? So we really don't start our planting in earnest till the beginning of October. So people have plenty of time to still, you know, buy stuff, look at their yard and decide, you know, like where they need some spring interest and, you know, purchase those bulbs. And we will hold on to them until we're ready to plant them. And what we do at the garden is we put them in this well house area that's like a little bit of a cooler environment. It's like, say, 50-ish degrees to like hold them until we're ready to plant them. So I would suggest that you put it, you know, maybe in your basement or something until you're ready to actually plant those bulbs in the fall. And one final thought that is rattling around in this brain of mine is that despite, you know, like all the best times to do everything, all these bulbs that you planted in previous years, you know, are still in the ground in our environment that we have right now. And they're usually coming up successfully in the springtime. So, you know, you can obviously, I don't think you can go wrong if you planted them now, because all the bulbs from previous years are in the ground living fine. You know, so sometimes you have to do it on the timeline that you have based on your busy life and availability, and just hope for the best and know that probably it's going to work out, because it does. What, just because that's how nature works.
Do you have some favorite bulb resources, places to get them?
Definitely. We get a lot of ours from this place called Color Blends, and they have, you know, their website is colorblends.com. And the reason is we got a bunch of them back when I first started, which was almost 20 years ago now. And, you know, they had some of the best sized bulbs for the most reasonable cost. And they're really easy to work with. They have a great website where you can, you know, order them immediately and get them really fast. We also do use Brent and Becky's bulbs, which has really unique specialty bulbs for the connoisseurs out there. People that are looking to get a little more something interesting or might have, you know, like a smaller space or want a specific color thing that Color Blends doesn't have in their palette of bulbs. And then there is a whole bunch of other different, you know, online sources that you can look at. And you can even just, you know, stop into a local garden center or even, like I said, the big box store and pick up some bulbs that catch your fancy. And oftentimes you can find some of the ones that are in those catalogs at those local places as well. So, you know, I say look for ones that interest you, and like the daffodils and things, if you read up about them on those websites, you kind of can get really into it a lot. But there's certain ones like one called Teatea, that's like a little small one we like, and Tahiti, which is like a double flower daffodil that, you know, I often see for sale even in like a big box store, that are like really good cultivars that you can just find when you're perusing other merchandise.
Our guest today, Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. We've been talking about bulbs for the most part, but we'll certainly take other flower and shrub-related questions as well as we visit with Mark, so I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Coming up on our show on Monday, we'll talk about lower back pain with our physical therapy experts, and then we'll take a look at dealing with an empty nest, which many people are probably going through in this fall season as school gets back to running. Right now, though, we're taking a look at plants, flowering plants, with Mark Conlock, Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. A couple of email questions for you, Mark. Jan in Viroqua called, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know what fertilizer should Jan be using on bulbs. Jan also wanted to share that they had good success with planting bulbs in flower pots and putting them in the refrigerator for 13 weeks before planting them outside.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, well, that's a good good tip for those people that didn't plant their bulbs and might want to try to do the same thing that Jan did successfully. So that's a great idea. Interesting thing is, like, when you plant bulbs, you don't have to really add any fertilizer because the bulb already has a flower formed inside of it. Kind of a really cool thing you can do yourself or with a kid in your family is if you dissect a tulip or daffodil bulb, you'll actually see like the small leaves and flower inside of there. And then the outside part of the bulb is like the food that will push it up and that'll, you know, cause it to grow. So we don't ever fertilize our bulbs at the botanical garden when we plant them, and we typically don't fertilize them ever afterward. The only reason we would do it is like the question you asked in the beginning, where if they, you know, get too tightly packed together and then they don't flower, then that would mean that they would require fertilizer. So a lot of times places will say, you know, different things you can put in, like blood meal, bone meal, or whatever, but we haven't ever done that for our bulbs. We did back a while ago use, you know, like Milorganite as an animal deterrent when we first planted, you know, like to put that on the top. So the process we use that might be helpful for other, you know, people to know is that we'll plant the bulbs, we'll mulch that area typically, we'll give them a really good soak of water, and then we will spray that area with liquid fence or some other animal deterrent to like try to keep, you know, animals from going around there. And we also will like, you know, of course, like blow and clean up to try to get the, like the tunics and the part of the bulbs that fall off so that animals like squirrels and chipmunks and stuff don't use those as like a way to find the bulbs.
Makes good sense to me. Dale in Madison has a question for you. Dale, hello.
Hello. My neighbor next to me has a tree which I believe is a staghorn sumac.
Okay.
And it has sent out roots into my yard, and so currently I have about 5 to 6 plants growing. And I've looked at the root structure, and it's pretty woody right now. And I had thought about transplanting them to a different place in my yard, but are they going to be more invasive around another tree or pine tree?
Good question, Rob. Dale. Yeah, I mean, Larry is already kind of smiling a little bit. Yeah, staghorn sumac, you know, is like a suckering shrub that will take over, but that's not necessarily right a bad thing in the right location. And it is native to Wisconsin, has a nice fall color and everything. So a couple of things you could do is, you know, where those suckers or have you like put shoots out into your yard, you could, yeah, you could like cut on either side of that root that it's coming from with a shovel. And what I would say is maybe what you want to do if you want to try to successfully transplant them is I would like, you know, do that now, cut that, but I would not maybe transplant it until next spring, because where you cut it, you'll have pruned it in essence, and it would maybe put out roots that would be more successful for the piece in the middle for you to be able to transplant in the springtime. You know, that would be one way to do it. If you don't want to, like, in that area where he has his or she has hers, the neighbor coming into your yard, you know, you would have to like keep cutting those off, or like, you know, cut the root on your property back to the property line, I guess. But it's always going to be a constant problem of that, you know, existing mother plant, if you will, coming into your yard. But I do like the fact that you're interested in propagating it and, you know, bringing it to the other parts of your yard. Of course, you could also, you know, buy a plant of staghorn sumac from a nursery and for sure successfully plant it in a different part of your yard. Yeah. Any thoughts on it all, Larry?
I was just to clarify, with the shovel, the spade, you'd just dig down on one side of the plant and then just leave it until spring and then transplant it if you're going to do it that way.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that made sense to me. Dale, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ross in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I planted 8 hydrangea plants, kind of the ones that look like little trees. They're 6 foot tall. I bought them from a nursery. They look awesome when I planted them. But when I dug them down with a fence hole puller, I dug them down about 18, 16 inches. The pots were that I bought them from were 14 inches deep. So there's a little bit of loose soil on the bottom. But what I dug down into, the first couple inches was black soil, and then it got kind of a little rocky, and then it got to kind of clay. And I had a hard time digging them out. Someone said, just fill the holes full of water. So I filled the holes full of water overnight until it kind of loosened up the dirt that I could dig a little bit better. And then when I planted them, my brother-in-law filled the holes, just pumped full of water again and within a week now, it's been about a week since I planted them, all the leaves are turning yellow like they're in shock. Or overwatered, I don't know whether to water them again or leave them alone, but the soil is kind of clayish. And so I'm kind of sitting here wondering, what should I do, water them or leave them alone?
So do you mean that, like, when you first dug into the soil, the top part was black soil and clay, and then you got to a layer of gravel and sand and more like open type material?
Yes. And then even a little bit deeper, the last 3-4 inches were kind of clay, because after I watered them, it was just like digging through cement, but it made it easier to dig the hole out because it was so hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a lot to think about there, I'd say, but a couple just things in general. Okay. So when you have like a fine soil, this happens in containers and things too, you know, like where it's not recommended that in a container planting, people really put gravel or soda cans or whatever in the bottom, because what happens is the water stays in the small pore space of a finer soil or clay soil or like a garden soil, and then it doesn't drain into that open space of the bigger like sand particles. So, you know, in some ways you might have a case where that soil, if it's, you know, rocky, it has a lot of big pore spaces, and your water is staying in the like black soil part that's up higher and not draining out of it. So that could be one thing that's holding moisture up high. But the other thing would be, you know, so what you really want to do is, like, you know, put your finger way down in there, or buy, like, I just saw actually again in this American Gardener magazine, they had like a little fine soil probe that's like pretty inexpensive that you can like put into the ground to see what the moisture is. But a lot of times we just will, you know, dig in with our finger or a soil knife, you know, that you can get 6 inches deep and see how wet it is, and if that moisture is being held up on the roots that, you know, where you said you might be too wet there. But in the other quick thing to tell you though, Ross, is like when you are planting, you do want to just plant into your existing soil, even if it's garbage, and plant plants that like that soil versus like amending it and doing, you know, putting a lot of black dirt, if you will, because then the roots will just stay in that nicer soil and never mind the outside parts of your soil profile for water and nutrients. And then they'll be more susceptible to drought. So, you know, I think you did the right thing by planting in the soil that you have. You can, as a soil amendment on the outside ring, I usually like to put it at the drip line and beyond, you know, like put an inch of compost that then can percolate down and kind of like add to the soil that might not be the best around there. And definitely like put 2 to 3 inches of organic mulch around the outside of that. You know, like you don't want it up against the trunk, but you want it, you know, maybe 3 inches away from those standard hydrangeas and then outward to the drip line and beyond to like help hold moisture so that, you know, you water it once a week, a good deep, thorough watering, and then it, you let it dry out in between waterings. So I don't think you should water it until you check to see how moist your soil is. And, you know, it may be a bit of like, I hope it's not too far gone already, but I would definitely let it dry out first, check it, and then water it thoroughly, you know, like once a week, let it dry between waters and check it. And make sure the other quick thing is because, you know, it's been warm and dry in our Septembers and Octobers for everybody, for all of our plants, all of us should make sure that we water, you know, in September and even October now so that our new trees, shrubs, and perennials go into winter stronger. So they're more likely to make it through the winter, whatever kind of winter we have, whether it's snowy or not. So that's maybe not the best answer, but that's what I would say is I would just check for water and not water it if it's moist to let it dry out because of how much you guys watered it in the first place. What do you think, Larry?
I think that's a pretty good answer, Mark. Thank you very much, Ross, for calling. Appreciate it. Ann in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Okay, about amaryllis plants. I have several amaryllis that bloomed nicely last winter. The leaves have continued to grow. I put them outside in the shade, and the leaves kept growing and growing. Now I put the pots back inside, and my question is, will they rebloom if the leaves keep growing, or do they need to die off?
That is a great question too. What I have done is a very similar thing to what you have done, where I've grown them outside all summer long, and then what you do, just like you did, is you bring it inside, but then you stop watering it, and you do want to let the leaves, you know, dry off and dry down and die off, and then you need to put it in a dark environment for like 12 to 14 weeks. You can look it up, but that's about what it usually says to do. So I actually put it like in a closet where I have all my work clothes. I mean, so it does get like lit up when I walk in there, but I'll put it in there and I'll also write down on my calendar, you know, when I need to take it out of that dark period. So it needs that like dry, dark storage. You can just put the whole pot or container into that area if you have enough space. That's what I typically do in my like walk-in closet thing I have. Or you can, you know, take the bulb out of there and just have the bulb be in that dark environment. And then after that time period, you would take it out and start, you know, giving it some water, plant it back in soil if you took it out of soil, and then it will rebloom. It's just that it won't typically bloom the time like when you bought it, it blooms. So I've done that many years, and I've even like collected seed, and we've grown them at the botanical garden. And we have like a double red one that we've collected seed from amaryllis for. So it's actually possible to do. It just can be a bit time consuming. And sometimes people will say, hey, I'll just buy a new bulb and then I don't have to do any of that work. But you do kind of get attached to them. So I would definitely go for it. And so bring it in, let it dry down and die down, put it into a dark environment, dry for 12 to 14 weeks or whatever you find that when you Google it, and then take it out, give it a little water, and it'll bloom, you know, maybe around a different time of the year, like Easter or something like that.
All right. And there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. Ellen in Eau Claire had called, couldn't stay with us. Ellen wants to know if there are bulbs that are deer resistant and do better in shade.
Okay, well, that's a, yeah, there's a couple of them that we've used here. There's one, I can never pronounce the Latin name the best, but it's like Leucosimum or something like that. They call it like, I think it's winter snowflake or giant snowflake or giant snowdrop. But that one is a good one for shade. Its leaves look like a daffodil, but it kind of looks like a giant snowdrop. So that one, again, is one you can get from Color Blends. And then the like Spanish bluebells are another one that can grow in some part shade. And they bloom a little bit later in the late spring, early summer, but they have a beautiful blue flower and they can take some part shade pretty well too. So those two are great ones for part shade environments.
Let's turn to an email from Mark in Madison. Several years ago in the fall, they planted a bunch of bulbs using both an auger to get a deeper hole and a hand trowel for faster but shallower stabs and drop planting. The next morning, all the auger hole plantings had been dug up, presumably by squirrels, but the stab and plant bulbs were unbothered. Mark was not happy about losing the day's augering effort, but also puzzled about the reason for the stark dichotomy. Was it perhaps easier for the bushy-tailed tree rats to locate the bulbs by smell or dig through the soil loosened by the auger?
Those sound like pretty good ideas to me, you know, that it would be the looser soil of the auger, right? And it's really noticeable where that auger was. Like I mentioned, how we'll kind of cover up those areas and put liquid fence on there is a way, you know, to keep that from happening. But I would guess that those are pretty good thoughts by Mark on why they dug it up in the augered holes, because they were easier to dig in and really noticeable holes. So yeah. In the future, I would say, you know, definitely could hand trowel them all, or you could try to, you know, put some mulch and spray the soil surface with some kind of smelly thing that repels animals. And like I said, the other thing is if you're planting a bunch and you knock those outside covering tunics off, it's good to like kind of blow those away or get those out of the way so there's no clue for these Sherlock Holmes squirrels to find the place to go.
Jim in Abbotsford, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. My question is, I planted some gladiolas in a raised bed garden, and when they started to flower, they dry up right away. The first flower, second flower, and then they just dry up and never bloom anymore. I don't know if I did something wrong or not.
Boy, I don't know for sure either, Jim. As long as you know, like planted them, kept them watered good. I don't know, you know, like what kind of gladiolus, you know, issue that could be, honestly. The only thing I could say would be to, you know, make sure they were well watered, that they might dry out in a raised bed pretty, you know, easily. But sounds like you kind of had done everything right. I don't know if there is a disease of a gladiola like that, unfortunately, but.
Yeah, I don't know either. We're a little stumped on that one, Jim. It could have been a water question issue. But beyond that, I'm not sure either. Maybe somebody else has an idea, can call in with a suggestion. 800-642-1234. Let's go to Connie in Green Bay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I first have to give a quick shout out and thank Mark for all the work he did when he helped us with the pollinator habitat at NWTC. Thanks, Mark. and then I have a question. The blue stem grass that we have growing in our pollinator habitat is growing beautifully. We have a few patches of them, and we want to transplant one. Would it be best to do it now in the fall or wait till spring to move that?
Okay. What I like to say to everybody about those kinds of questions is do it whenever you want to. As long as you get like a good, like the entire root system, which can be, you know, hard and make it, you know, a bigger, heavier plant to move, you know, like with those, I would say you could do it now and then, you know, make sure you may have to make sure that you water it in to successfully transplant it again into that September, October time period is probably, you know, safest to do it in the spring or early summer. But, you know, little bluestem being a warm season grass doesn't oftentimes start growing like immediately right away. It takes it a little bit to like grow and come out of the ground. So you might want to wait till the spring, but then, you know, you have to wait till you can kind of like see the clump and what's alive of it actually. So I think you can do that anytime, but you know, you're safer in spring. But if you want to do it because you want to get it done and you want to like, you know, move on from that area and try it, I would say that you could still do it now, even though it means you have to get a good part of the root system and you need to make sure that you don't just transplant it and forget about it, that you give it that inch of water to get it established and to make sure it goes into the winter strong.
Makes sense. Connie, good luck. Thank you. Jane in Marinette. On to you now. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I've got a single peony plant that I've had for quite a while, and every year I keep thinking it's going to blossom more than one bud. And so I was going to transplant it this fall, which I heard is the best time. And I want to make, should I put other peony plants with it and then transplant it so that where there is full sun?
All right. Peonies in full sun?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely want to put it in full sun. And when you transplant it, you know, you want to make sure that you don't plant it too deep. I believe you only want like the eyes of it to be about an inch or so deep because, you know, peonies that are planted deep can like be quote unquote blind where they won't flower. So that, I mean, maybe that's even a reason why it only has one flower right now. So when you do dig it up, take a look at where, you know, those growing points are and make sure on your transplant that you only have those like an inch or so below the soil surface so that you do, more likely you'll get more flowers just by that transplanting of it like that. And definitely full sun, more sun, the more energy, the more flowers you'll get.
Jane, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Mark, we sent you an email about an azalea plant, so you can be looking at that while I remind everybody that Mark Conlock is Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Join with your questions. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Talking plants today and flowering plants with Mark Conlock of the Green Bay Botanical Garden. We will go right back to the phones. Lyle in Montello, it's your turn now. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, guys. You guys were talking about the bulb yards earlier.
Yeah.
And ways to do that. I was wondering what you thought about maybe using like a yard aerator to punch the holes in and then come through and plug the holes in or the bulbs into those.
Yeah, no, that sounds like an interesting idea. I guess the only quick thing that came off the top of my head would be your bulbs would be like kind of on a grid pattern. That way, you know, where you might want to actually go over it a couple times in different directions or, you know, kind of like, you know, do it so that you don't have holes that are just when you plant it, it'll look like, you know, a giant checkerboard.
Yeah, that makes sense. Or you could throw them out there, like you said, Mark, earlier, note the paint them or something so you can tell where they are. And then just do your own kind of sprinkling them around right where they fell.
Yeah, or put them, you know, not put them in every single hole that you punch with the aerator, you know, throw them out there and then put them to the closest hole and fill everything with soil and just some might not have a bulb in them.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Lyle, that'll work. Thanks for calling. Whitney in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Whitney.
Hi, Larry. I'm a big fan. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've got a question about, we've gotten really into pollinator-friendly gardens at our house lately, and we are hooked. So we've had beds, but we want to replace the entire boulevard in front of our house with a pollinator garden next spring. But we don't really want to fight with the grass. Should we go ahead and try to kill our grass this year, or should we wait until next spring?
I would say to go ahead and kill your grass this year. There, you know, we've done a couple of these pollinator corridor habitats with the city of Green Bay, where we're trying to build this corridor between the east and west side of the city, and we're doing, you know, a pretty good job. And when they do the Green Bay Conservation Corps does a lot of the work ahead of us. We grow the plants and help them plant them and do the design. But this year it was really great because they did all of the turf removal the previous fall, and then they prepared the area by, you know, putting mulch on it. so that it was all ready to go and you don't have to worry about how much it rains in the springtime. It doesn't slow you up from, you know, what other weather implications there might be. And it kind of like lets everything just like be ready to do the job as soon as you have the plants in the, you know, spring, summer of next year. So a couple ways you can do it, of course, like what they do at the Conservation Corps is just literally remove all the sod with a sod cutter and by hand and then mulch it. You could, of course, if you're, you know, willing or interested, use an herbicide to do that still with the warm temperatures, you know, that we're going to have. That would be effective. You could do the solarization with, you know, black plastic, but that, of course, takes time. So you probably wouldn't have time to do that this year still. So you're probably, I guess I'd say as I'm talking here, that your options are herbicide or stripping off that sod. And then I would go ahead and put, you know, the 2 to 3 inches of an organic mulch on there and then be all ready to plant it the next year.
Yeah, there you go. I'll have that myself next year because we had street repairs. And so my native area, which ran between the sidewalk and the street, is long gone. And I'm going to have to do it all again, all over again next spring. Whitney, there you go. Thanks for calling. Dave in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I have a Weigelia plant, or I don't know, maybe it's Weigelia plant. I'm not sure how people pronounce it, but it's got green flower or green leaves, and it climbs, and it's got red flowers. And I believe it only is supposed to last for one season, but wondering if I could bring it in and have it over winter and then take it back out in the spring if it would still come back.
I mean, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly what you have. You know, a Weigelia is definitely a plant that grows in Wisconsin, but it's a shrub, you know, that it does, you know, it's hardy to our area. So it's going to come back year after year and bloom in the summer. Do you know if it's something else that you have?
That's what the tag said. So I bought it at a floral place in the spring of the year that doesn't really sell a lot of shrubs and things. It's more flowers. So
okay, well, but Dave, feel free to, you know, take a picture of that tag and email me it to, you know, my email at the garden, mconlock@gbbg.org, and I can take a look at it and see if it's that or something different, and then I'll get back to you on, you know, what to do. If it is a vine, you know, some of them you can overwinter, but sometimes it's, you know, easier just to pitch it and buy a new one in the springtime because it's just like not worth the effort to overwinter it if it's a tropical vine.
Yeah, for sure. Dave, thank you very much for calling. You can still join in at 800-642-1234. Mark, we've got a couple of photos too that we got. The one is about an azalea, and I don't know if you have that up.
Yeah, I saw it. It's like, you know, pretty chlorotic and speckled.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not totally sure what that is, honestly. So that's another one kind of similar to Dave's where I'll have to do some further investigation and then I can get back to the email about that. I did look at, there was another one we had that you're probably going to mention, the cottonwood tree, and not exactly sure what the speckling on that is, but I would say for that, you know, there are a lot of cosmetic just leaf diseases, and I wouldn't be too overly concerned about that if it is just, you know, the leaf discoloration, because, you know, later in the season we've had the different conditions, you know, for different diseases to be there. Those pathogens are out there, and when it's just the leaves, you know, they fall off anyway, and unless it's something on, you know, the woody tissue, you really don't have to be worried about those like cosmetic leaf diseases on a lot of trees and things. At least that's what I learned in my short time at the extension.
We had an email relating to an earlier email from Mark who had his bulb plants, the ones that he did with an auger, all dug up the next day by the squirrels. And Vicki in Eau Claire called with a suggestion. She suggests protecting the bulbs from being dug up by using some kind of chicken wire or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you have, you know, like a small area or say, you know, a garden bed that you incorporate bulbs amongst other things, that, you know, it's small enough to be able to like cover it with hardware cloth or chicken wire or something like that. Other times people will like, you know, say they planted a container of bulbs or something, they might put like, you know, angular rocks or, you know, gravel in there to like make it less likely that animals will want to like dig through that material. So those are a couple of different options, especially like the hardware cloth or chicken wire, like she mentioned.
I don't want time to get away before we talk about some of the events, Mark. And I know your holiday light show at the Green Bay Botanical Garden is always spectacular. Tell us what people are going to see this year.
Yeah, definitely. That's a very exciting time. We have about, you know, 350,000 lights and 40 different nature-inspired displays out there. We're actually going to be setting that up pretty soon. You know, that usually takes us quite a while to set all those lights up and get everything going so that it's ready for the Friday after Thanksgiving is when it opens and it goes through after Christmas. So we have all of our awesome displays that we've had in the past, but a couple of the new ones that I've seen or got a little sneak peek of are one that's called Tic Tac Snow, where it's an interactive giant tic-tac-toe board that you get to like do with your friends or family. So that sounds pretty cool, and I like the play on words of it. And the other bigger one is a laser with fog machine. So I saw like a little setup video of it where it has, you know, it's still in the works of being programmed, but it has like a laser dragonflies flying around on our stage and going through the smoke and different, you know, patterns throughout the air swirling around in our grand garden amphitheater area. So that looks really exciting and different and a new technology, you know, to add to the light show to go amongst all of the things that we already have out there. So I'm excited to see that in motion.
And when does it start again?
It starts November 28th. So the Friday after Thanksgiving is the first kickoff day, and then it goes till after Christmas. So all of that stuff is on our website, which is gbbg.org. And there'll be all the special information about the light show on there soon. If it's not there right now, I believe, but it'll be up there soon. And quick other thing is we have new this year, an app. So there'll be information about that light show on the app. So if you go to, you know, the App Store or the Google Play Store, it's just Green Bay Botanical Garden you search for, and then you can get information about everything happening on that app. And it also let you know where you are in the garden so you won't get lost as you're navigating through all these amazing things.
It's great. Yeah, you got a lot to see there. I've always enjoyed visiting the garden, and it's a big area.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, the other thing there is right now everything is really looking great in the garden. So if you know, if you're coming up for a Packer game or going up to Door County to see the lights, you know, swing on by and say hi to us, because all of our annuals are still in bloom in their full glory. And then all of the perennials, trees, and shrubs that we have, which is over 100,000 permanent plants in our collection now, which has grown quite a bit. So there's a lot of great things to see in the fall. And because it, you know, has been so nice and mild and we've been watering all those things, they're looking amazing still. We haven't had frost and don't anticipate that for a little bit up here. So come on by and say hi to all the plants at Green Bay Botanical Garden, and you know, check out our website for information about other events and things that might interest you.
I love the garden. And how many years has the garden been in existence?
2025 minus 1996 is.
Well, it'd be 29 years if you ask me.
Yeah, so 29 years, yeah.
29 years. And I remember being a speaker at one of the fundraisers, one of your big fundraisers before it opened. And I've had that association all those years. And it's certainly been well worth it, and quite an addition to the Green Bay area, and not only Green Bay, but people come from all over to see it. So thank you for your work.
You bet, and thanks for being part of it, Larry. We really consider ourselves, you know, a community garden, kind of like in a different way than vegetables, where I know it's been a lot of people in our community that have built this garden and take care of it and love it and support it in all different ways. So we just love sharing it with everyone that comes to this area and love sharing it with our community.
Next time I'm up there, I'll have to chat with you about that original talk I gave sometime. Mark, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Larry.
Mark Conlock, director of the horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. He'll be back, and we'll do it again with him. Oh, man. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about your lawns, so look forward to that. And thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to our team for producing our shows every day. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Have a great time and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.